so they needed more water. But the seismic scans were finding no evidence of ice aquifers underground, and Anne thought there weren't any in the region. They had to continue to rely on the air miners, or scrape up regolith and load it into the soil water distilleries. But Nadia didn't like to overwork the distilleries, because they had been manufactured by a French-Hungarian-Chinese consortium and were sure to wear out if used for bulk work. But that was life on Mars. It was a dry place. Chakata Ganai. There are always choices, Phyllis said to that. This was why she had suggested filling landing vehicles with Phobos ice and bringing it on down. But Anne thought that was a ridiculous waste of energy. And they were off again. It was especially irritating to Nadia because she herself was in such a good mood. She saw no reason to quarrel, and it disturbed her that the others didn't feel the same. Why did the dynamics of a group fluctuate so? Here they were on Mars, where the seasons were twice as long as Earth's, and every day was 40 minutes longer. Why couldn't people relax? Nadia had a sense that there was time for things even though she was always busy, and the extra 39.5 minutes per day was probably the most important component of this feeling. Human circadian biorhythms had been set over millions of years of evolution, and now suddenly to have extra minutes of day and night, day after day, night after night, no doubt it had effects. Nadia was sure of it, because despite the hectic pace of every day's work and the way she passed out in sheer exhaustion every night, she always woke rested. That strange pause on the digital clocks, when at midnight the figures hit 12 and suddenly stopped, and the unmarked time passed, passed, passed. Sometimes it seemed for a very long time indeed, and then snapped on to 1 second past 12, and began its usual inexorable flicker. Well, the Martian time slip was something special. Often Nadia was asleep through it, as were most of the rest of them. But Hiroko had a chant that she chanted during it when she was up, and she and the farm team and many of the rest of them spent every Saturday night partying and chanting that chant through the time slip. Something in Japanese, Nadia never learned what, though she sometimes hummed along, sitting, enjoying the vault and her friends. But one Saturday night when she sat there, nearly comatose, Maya came over and sat against her shoulder for a talk. Maya, with her beautiful face, always well-groomed, always the latest in chicarnist, even in their everyday jumpsuits, looking distraught. Nadia, you have to do me a favor, please, please. What? I need you to tell something to Frank for me. Why don't you do it yourself? I can't have John seeing us talk. I have to get a message to him, and please, Nadezhda Francine, you're my only way. Nadia made a disgusted noise. Please. It was surprising how much Nadia would have rather been talking to Anne, or Samantha, or Arkady. If only Arkady would come down from Phobos. But Maya was her friend, and that desperate look on her face, Nadia couldn't stand it. What message? Tell him that I'll meet him tonight in the storage area, Maya said imperiously. At midnight. To talk. Nadia sighed, but later she went to Frank and gave him the message. He nodded without meeting her eye, embarrassed, grim, unhappy. Then a few days later, Nadia and Maya were cleaning up the brick floor of the latest chamber to be pressurized, and Nadia's curiosity got the best of her. She broke her customary silence on the topic and asked Maya what was going on. Well, it's John and Frank, Maya said querulously. They're very competitive. They're like brothers, and there's a lot of jealousy there. John got to Mars first, and then he got permission to come back again, and Frank doesn't think it was fair. Frank did a lot of the work in Washington to get the colony funded, and he thinks John has always taken advantage of his work. And now, well, John and I are good together. I like him. It's easy with him. Easy, but maybe a little, I don't know, not boring, but not exciting. He likes to walk around, hang out with the farm crew. He doesn't like to talk that much. Frank, now, we could talk forever, argue forever maybe, but at least we're talking. And you know, we had a very brief affair on the Ares back at the beginning, and it didn't work out, but he still thinks it could. Why would he think that? Nadia mouthed. So he keeps trying to talk me into leaving John and being with him, and John suspects that's what he's doing, so there's a lot of jealousy between them. I'm just trying to keep them from each other's throats, that's all. Nadia decided to stick to her resolve and not ask about it again. But now she was involved, despite herself. Maya kept coming to her to talk and to ask her to convey messages to Frank for her. I'm not a go-between, Nadia kept protesting, but she kept doing it, and once or twice when she did, she got into long conversations with Frank, about Maya, of course. Who she was, what she was like, why she acted the way she did. Look, Nadia said to him, I can't speak for Maya. I don't know why she does what she does. You have to ask her yourself. But I can tell you she comes out of the old Moscow Soviet culture, university and CP for both her mother and her grandmother. And men were the enemies for Maya's babushka, and for her mother, too. It was a matryoshka. Maya's mother used to say to her, women are the roots, men are just the leaves. There was a whole culture of mistrust, manipulation, fear. That's where Maya comes from. And at the same time, we have this tradition of amikachanstva, a kind of intense friendship where you learn the very tiniest details of your friend's life. You invade each other's lives, in a sense. And of course, that's impossible, and it has to end, usually badly. Frank was nodding at this description, recognizing something in it. Nadia sighed and went on. These are the friendships that lead to love. And then love has the same sort of trouble, only magnified, especially with all that fear at the bottom of it. And Frank, tall, dark, and somehow handsome, bulky with power, spinning with his own internal dynamo, the American politician, now wrapped around the finger of a neurotic Russian beauty, Frank nodded humbly and thanked her, looking discouraged. As well he should. Nadia did her best to ignore all that, but it seemed everything else had turned problematic as well. Vlad had never approved of how much time they were spending on the surface in the daytime, and now he said, we ought to stay under the hill most of the time and bury all the labs as well. Outdoors work should be restricted to an hour in the early mornings and another in the late afternoons when the sun is low. I'll be damned if I stay indoors all day, Anne said, and many agreed with her. We've got a lot of work to do, Frank pointed out. But most of it could be done by teleoperation, Vlad said, and it should be. What we are doing is the equivalent of standing 10 kilometers from an atomic explosion. So, Anne said, soldiers did that every 6 months, Vlad finished and stared at her. Would you do that? Even Anne looked subdued. No ozone layer, no magnetic field to speak of. They were getting fried by radiation, almost as badly as if they were in interplanetary space, to the tune of 10 rems per year. And so Frank and Maya ordered them to ration their time outdoors. There was a lot of interior work to be done under the hill, getting the last row of chambers finished, and it was possible to dig some cellars below the vaults, giving them some more space protected from radiation. And many of the tractors were equipped to be teleoperated from indoor stations, their decision algorithms handling the details while the human operators watched screens below. So it could be done, but no one liked the life that resulted. Even Sax Russell, who was content to work indoors most of the time, looked a bit perplexed. In the evenings, a number of people began to argue for immediate terraforming efforts, and they made the case with renewed intensity. That's not our decision to make, Frank told them sharply. The UN decides that one. Besides, it's a long-term solution, on the scale of centuries at best. Don't waste time talking about it. Anne said, "That's all true, but I don't want to waste my time down here in these caves either. We should live our lives the way we want. We're too old to worry about radiation." Arguments again. Arguments that made Nadia feel as if she had floated off the good solid rock of her planet back into the tense, weightless reality of the Ares. Carping, complaining, arguing, until people got bored or tired and went to sleep. Nadia started leaving the room whenever it began, looking for Hiroko and a chance to discuss something concrete. But it was hard to avoid these matters, to stop thinking about them. Then one night Maya came to her crying. There was room in the permanent habitat for private talks, and Nadia went with her down to the northeast corner of the vaults, where they were still working on interiors, and sat by her arm to arm, shivering and listening to her, and occasionally putting an arm over her shoulder and giving her a hug. "Look," Nadia said at one point, "why don't you just decide? Why don't you quit playing one off against the other?" "But I have decided. It's John I love. It's always been John. But now he's seen me with Frank and he thinks I've betrayed him. It's really petty of him. They're like brothers. They compete in everything. And this time it's just a mistake." Nadia resisted learning the details. She didn't want to hear it. She sat there listening anyway. And then John was standing there before them. Nadia got up to leave, but he didn't appear to notice. "Look," he said to Maya, "I'm sorry, but I can't help it. It's over." "It's not over," Maya said, instantly composed. "I love you." John's smile was rueful. "Yes, and I love you. But I want things simple."
"It is simple."
"No, it isn't. I mean, you can be in love with more than one person at the same time. Anyone can. That's just the way it is. But you can only be loyal to one. And I want to be loyal. To someone who is loyal to me. It's simple, but..." He shook his head. He couldn't find the phrase. He walked back into the eastern row of chambers, disappeared through a door. "Americans," Maya said viciously. "Fucking children!" Then she was up through the door after him. But soon she came back. He had retreated to a group in one of the lounges and wouldn't leave. "I'm tired," Nadia tried to say, but Maya wouldn't hear it. She was getting more and more upset. For over an hour they discussed it, over and over. Eventually Nadia agreed to go to John and ask him to come to Maya and talk it over. Nadia walked grimly through the chambers, oblivious to the brick and the colorful nylon hangings. The go-between that nobody noticed. Couldn't they get robots to do this? She found John, who apologized for ignoring her earlier. "I was upset, I'm sorry. I figured you'd hear it all eventually anyway." Nadia shrugged. "No problem. But look, you have to go talk to her. That's the way it is with Maya. We talk, talk, talk. If you contract to be in a relationship, you have to talk your way all the way through it, and all the way out of it. If you don't, it will be worse for you in the long run, believe me." That got to him. Sobered, he went off to find Maya. Nadia went to bed. The next day, she was out working late on a trencher. It was the third job of the day, and the second had been trouble. Samantha had tried to carry a load on the earth mover blade while making a turn, and the thing had taken a nosedive and twisted the rods of the blade lifters out of their casings, spilling hydraulic fluid over the ground, where it had frozen before it even flattened out. They had had to set jacks under the airborne back end of the tractor, and then decouple the entire blade attachment and lower the vehicle on the jacks. And every step of the operation had been a pain. Then, as soon as that was finished, Nadia had been called over to help with a Sandvik Tubex boring machine, which they were using to drill cased holes through large boulders they ran into while laying a water line from the alchemists to the permanent habitat. The down-the-hole pneumatic hammer had apparently frozen at full extension, as stuck as an arrow shot most of the way through a tree. Nadia stood looking down at the hammer shaft. Do you have any suggestions for freeing the hammer without breaking it? Spencer asked. Break the boulder, Nadia said wearily, and walked over and got in a tractor with a backhoe already attached. She drove it over, dug down to the top of the boulder, and then got out to attach a little Allied hydraulic impact hammer to the backhoe. She had just set it in position on the top of the boulder when the down-the-hole hammer suddenly jerked its drill back, pulling the boulder with it and catching the outside of her left hand against the underside of the Allied high ram. Instinctively, she pulled back, and pain lanced up her arm and into her chest. Fire filled that side of her body, and her vision went white. There were shouts in her ears. What's wrong? What happened? She must have screamed. Help! She grated. She was sitting, her crushed hand still pinned between rock and hammer. She pushed at the front wheel of the tractor with her foot, shoved with all her might, and felt the hammer rasp her bones over rock. Then she was flopped on her back, the hand free. The pain was blinding. She felt sick to her stomach and thought she might faint. Pushing onto her knees with her good hand, she saw that the crushed hand was bleeding heavily, the glove ripped apart, the little finger apparently gone. She groaned and hunched over it, pressed it to her, and then jammed it against the ground, ignoring the flash of pain. Even bleeding as it was, the hand would freeze in... how long? Freeze, damn you, freeze! She cried. She shook tears out of her eyes and forced herself to look at it. Blood all over, steaming. She pushed the hand into the ground as hard as she could stand. Already it hurt less. Soon it would be numb. She would have to be careful not to freeze the whole hand. Frightened, she prepared to pull it back into her lap. Then people were there, lifting her, and she fainted. After that, she was maimed. Nadia Ninefingers, Arkady called her over the phone. He sent her lines by Yevtushenko, written to mourn the death of Louis Armstrong. Do as you did in the past, and play. How did you find that? Nadia asked him. I can't imagine you reading Yevtushenko. Of course I read him. It's better than McGonagall. No, this was in a book on Armstrong. I've taken your advice and been listening to him while we work, and lately reading some books on him at night. I wish you'd come down here, Nadia said. Vlad had done the surgery. He told her it would be all right. It caught you clean. The ring finger is a bit impaired and will act like the little finger used to, probably, but ring fingers never do much anyway. The two main fingers will be as strong as ever. Everyone came by to visit. Nevertheless, she spoke more with Arkady than anyone else, in the hours of the night when she was alone, in the 4.5 hours between Phobos's rising in the west and its setting in the east. He called in almost every night at first. And often thereafter. Pretty soon she was up and around, hand in a cast that was suspiciously slender. She went out to troubleshoot or consult, hoping to keep her mind occupied. Michel Duval never came by at all, which she thought was strange. Wasn't this what psychologists were for? She couldn't help feeling depressed. She needed her hands for her work. She was a hand laborer. The cast got in the way, and she cut off the part around the wrist with shears from her toolkit. But she had to keep both hand and cast in a box when outside, and there wasn't much she could do. It really was depressing. Saturday night arrived, and she sat in the newly filled whirlpool bath, nursing a glass of bad wine and looking around at her companions, splashing and soaking in their bathing suits. She wasn't the only one to have been injured by any means. They were all a bit battered now after so many months of physical work. Almost everyone had frostburn marks, patches of black skin that eventually peeled, leaving pink new skin, garish and ugly in the heat of the pools. And several others wore casts, on hands, wrists, arms, even legs, all for breaks or sprains. Actually, they were lucky no one had gotten killed yet. All these bodies... and none for her. They knew each other like family, she thought. They were each other's physicians. They slept in the same rooms, dressed in the same locks, bathed together. An unremarkable group of human animals, eye-catching in the inert world they occupied, but more comforting than exciting, at least most of the time. Middle-aged bodies. Nadia herself was as round as a pumpkin, a plump, tough, muscular, short woman, squarish and yet rounded, and single. Her closest friend these days was only a voice in her ear, a face on the screen. When he came down from Phobos, well, hard to say. He had had a lot of girlfriends on the Ares, and Janet Blylevin had gone to Phobos to be with him. People were arguing again, there in the shallows of the lap pool. Anne, tall and angular, leaning down to snap something at Sax Russell, short and soft. As usual, he didn't appear to be listening. She would hit him one day if he didn't watch out. It was strange how the group was changing again, how the feel of it was changing. She could never get a fix on it. The real nature of the group was a thing apart, with a life of its own, somehow distinct from the characters of the individuals that constituted it. It must make Michelle's job as their shrink almost impossible. Not that one could tell with Michelle. He was the quietest and most unobtrusive psychiatrist she had ever met, no doubt an asset in this group of shrink atheists. But she still thought it was odd he hadn't come by to see her after the accident. One evening she left the dining chambers and walked down to the tunnel they were digging from the vaulted chambers to the farm complex, and there at the tunnel's end were Maya and Frank, arguing in a vicious undertone that carried down the tunnel, not their meaning, but their feeling. Frank's face was contorted with anger, and Maya, as she turned from him, was distraught, weeping. She turned back to shout at him, "It was never like that!" and then ran blindly toward Nadia, her mouth twisted into a snarl, Frank's face a mask of pain. Maya saw Nadia standing there and ran right by her. Shocked, Nadia turned and walked back to the living chambers. She went up magnesium stairs to the living room in chamber 2 and turned on the TV to watch a 24-hour news program from Earth, something she very rarely did. After a while, she turned down the sound and looked at the pattern of bricks in the barrel vault overhead. Maya came in and started to explain things to her. There was nothing between her and Frank. It was in Frank's mind only. He just wouldn't give up on it, even though it had been nothing to begin with. She wanted only John, and it wasn't her fault that John and Frank were on such bad terms now. It was because of Frank's irrational desire. It wasn't her fault, but she felt so guilty because the two men had once been such close friends, like brothers. And Nadia listened with a careful show of patience, saying, "Da, da," and "I see," and the like, until Maya was lying flat on her back on the floor, crying, and Nadia was sitting on the edge of a chair staring at her, wondering how much of it was true, and what the argument had really been about, and whether she was a bad friend to distrust her old companion's story so completely. But somehow the whole thing felt like Maya covering her tracks, practicing another manipulation. It was just this. Those two distraught faces she had seen down the tunnel had been the clearest evidence possible of a fight between intimates. So Maya's explanation was almost certainly a lie. Nadia said something soothing to her and went off to bed, thinking, "You already have taken too much of my time and energy and concentration with these games. You cost me a finger with them, you bitch." It was a new year, getting toward the end of the long northern spring, and they still had no good supply of water, so Anne proposed to make an expedition to the Cap and set up a robot distillery, along the way establishing a route that rovers could follow on automatic pilot. "Come with us," she said to Nadia. "You haven't seen anything of the planet yet. Just the stretch between here and Chernobyl, and that's nothing. You missed Hebes and Ganges, and you're not doing anything new here. Really, Nadia, I can't believe what a grub you've been. I mean, why did you come to Mars after all?"
"Why?"
"Yes, why? I mean, there's two kinds of activities here. There's the exploration of Mars, and then there's the life support for that exploration. And here you've been completely immersed in the life support, without paying the slightest attention to the reason we came in the first place.
Well, it's what I like to do, Nadia said uneasily.
Fine, but try to keep some perspective on it. What the hell, you could have stayed back on Earth and been a plumber. You didn't have to come all this way to drive a goddamn bulldozer. Just how long are you going to go on grubbing away here, installing toilets, programming tractors?
All right, Nadia said, thinking of Maya and all the rest. The square of vaults was almost finished anyway. I could use a vacation.
They took off in three big long-range rovers, Nadia and five of the geologists, Anne, Simon Fraser, George Berkowitz, Phyllis Boyle, and Edvard Perrin. George and Edvard were friends of Phyllis's from their NASA days, and they supported her in advocating applied geological studies, meaning prospecting for rare metals. Simon, on the other hand, was a quiet ally of Anne's, committed to pure research and a hands-off attitude. Nadia knew all this, even though she had spent very little time alone with any of these people except for Anne. But talk was talk. She could have named all the allegiances of everyone at base if she had to. The expedition rovers were each composed of two four-wheeled modules, coupled by a flexible frame. They looked a bit like giant ants. They had been built by Rolls-Royce and a multinational aerospace consortium and had a beautiful sea-green finish. The forward modules contained the living quarters and had tinted windows on all four sides. The aft modules contained the fuel tanks and sported a number of black rotating solar panels. The eight wire mesh wheels were 2.5 meters high and very broad. As they headed north across Luni Planum, they marked their route with little green transponders, dropping one every few kilometers. They also cleared rocks from their path that might disable a robot-driven rover, using the snowplow attachment or the little crane at the front end of the first rover. So in effect, they were building a road. But they seldom had to use the rock-moving equipment on Luni. They drove northeast at nearly their full speed of 30 kilometers an hour for several days straight. They were heading northeast to avoid the canyon systems of Tempe and Mariottis, and this route took them down Luni to the long slope of Chrysi Planitia. Both these regions looked much like the land around their base camp, bumpy and strewn with small rocks, but because they were heading downhill, they often had much longer views than they were used to. It was a new pleasure to Nadia to drive on and see new countryside continually pop over the horizon, hillocks, dips, enormous isolated boulders, the occasional low, round mesa that was the outside of a crater. When they had descended to the lowlands of the northern hemisphere, they turned and drove straight north across the immense Acidalia Planitia, and again ran straight for several days. Their wheel tracks stretched behind them like the first cut of a lawnmower through grass, and the transponders gleamed bright and incongruous among the rocks. Phyllis, Edvard, and George talked about making a few side trips to investigate some indications seen in satellite photos that there were unusual mineral outcroppings near Perepelkin Crater. Anne reminded them irritably of their mission. It made Nadia sad to see that Anne was nearly as distant and tense out here as she was back at base. Whenever the rovers were stopped, she was outside walking around alone, and she was withdrawn when they sat together in Rover 1 to eat dinner. Occasionally, Nadia tried to draw her out. "Anne, how did all these rocks get scattered around like this?"
"Meteors."
"But where are the craters?"
"Most are in the south."
"But how did the rocks get here, then?"
"They flew. That's why they're so small. It's only smaller rocks could be tossed so far."
"But I thought you told me that these northern plains were relatively new, while the heavy cratering was relatively old."
"That's right.
The rocks you see here come from late meteor action. The total accumulation of loose rock from meteor strikes is much greater than what we can see. That's what Garden Regolith is, and the regolith is a kilometer deep."
"It's hard to believe," Nadia said. "I mean, that's so many meteors."
Anne nodded. It's billions of years. That's the difference between here and Earth. The age of the land goes from millions of years to billions. It's such a big difference it's hard to imagine, but seeing stuff like this can help. Midway across Acidalia, they began running into long, straight, steep-walled, flat-bottomed canyons. They looked, as George noted more than once, like the dry beds of the legendary canals. The geological name for them was fossae, and they came in clusters. Even the smallest of these canyons were impassable to rovers, and when they came on one, they had to turn and run along its rim until its floors rose or its walls drew together, and they could continue north over the flat plain again. The horizon ahead was sometimes 20 kilometers off, sometimes 3. Craters became rare, and the ones they passed were surrounded by low mounds that rayed out from the rims, splosh craters, where meteors had landed in permafrost that had turned to hot mud in the impact. Nadia's companions spent a day wandering eagerly over the splayed hills around one of these craters. The rounded slopes, Phyllis said, indicated ancient water as clearly as the grain in petrified wood indicated the original tree. By the way she spoke, Nadia understood that this was another of her disagreements with Anne. Phyllis believed in the long wet past model, Anne in the short wet past, or something like that. Science was many things, Nadia thought, including a weapon with which to hit other scientists. Farther north, around latitude 54, they drove into the weird-looking land of thermokarsts, hummocky terrain, spotted by a great number of steep-sided oval pits called alaces. These alaces were 100 times bigger than their Terran analogs, most of them 2 or 3 kilometers across and about 60 meters deep. A sure sign of permafrost, the geologists all agreed. Seasonal freezing and thawing of the soil caused it to slump in this pattern. Pits this big indicated that water content in the soil must have been high, Phyllis said. Unless it was yet another manifestation of Martian timescales, Anne replied. Slightly icy soil, slumping ever so slightly for eons. Irritably, Phyllis suggested that they try collecting water from the ground, and irritably, Anne agreed. They found a smooth slope between depressions and stopped to install a permafrost water collector. Nadia took charge of the operation with a feeling of relief. The trip's lack of work had begun to get to her. It was a good day's job. She dug a 10-meter-long trench with the lead rover's little backhoe, laid the lateral collector gallery, a perforated stainless steel pipe filled with gravel, checked the electric heating elements running in strips along the pipe and filters, then filled in the trench with the clay and rocks they had dug out earlier. Over the lower end of the gallery was a sump and pump and an insulated transport line leading to a small holding tank. Batteries would power the heating elements, and solar panels charge the batteries. When the holding tank was full, if there was enough water to fill it, the pump would shut off and a solenoid valve would open, allowing the water in the transport line to drain back into the gallery, after which the heating elements would shut off as well. Almost done, Nadia declared late in the day as she started to bolt the transport pipe onto the last magnesium post. Her hands were dangerously cold, and her maimed hand throbbed. Maybe someone could start dinner, she said. I'm almost done here. The transport pipe had to be packed in a thick cylinder of white polyurethane foam, then fitted into a larger protective pipe. Amazing how insulation complicated a simple piece of plumbing. Hex nut, washer, cotter pin, a firm tug on the wrench. Nadia walked along the line, checking the coupling bands at the joints. Everything firm. She lugged her tools over to Rover One, looked back at the result of the day's work. A tank, a short pipe on posts, a box on the ground, a long, low mound of disturbed soil running uphill, looking raw but otherwise not unusual in this land of lumps. We'll drink some fresh water on our way back, she said. They had driven north over 2,000 kilometers and finally rolled down onto Vastatas Borealis, an ancient cratered lava plain that ringed the northern hemisphere between latitudes 60 and 70. Anne and the other geologists spent a couple of hours every morning out on the bare, dark rock of this plain, taking samples, after which they would drive north for the rest of the day, discussing what they had found. Anne seemed more absorbed in the work, happier. One evening, Simon pointed out that Phobos was running just over the low hills to the south. The next day's drive would put it under the horizon. It was a remarkable demonstration of just how low the little moon's orbit was. They were only at latitude 69. But Phobos was only some 5,000 kilometers above the planet's equator. Nadia waved goodbye to it with a smile, knowing she would still be able to talk to Arkady using the newly arrived aerosynchronous radio satellites. 3 days later, the bare rock ended, running under waves of blackish sand. It was just like coming on the shore of a sea. They had reached the Great Northern Dunes, which wrapped the world in a band between Vastatas and the polar cap. Where they were going to cross, the band was about 800 kilometers wide. The sand was a charcoal color, tinged with purple and rose, a rich relief to the eye after all the red rubble of the south. The dunes trended north and south, in parallel crests that occasionally broke or merged. Driving over them was easy. The sand was hard-packed, and they only had to pick a big dune and run along its hump-backed western side. After a few days of this, however, the dunes got bigger and became what Anne called Barkan Dunes. These looked like huge frozen waves with faces 100 meters tall and backs 1 kilometer wide, and the crescent that each wave made was several kilometers long. As with so many other Martian landscape features, they were 100 times larger than their Terran analogs in the Sahara and Gobi. The expedition kept a level course over the backs of these great waves by contouring from one wave back to the next, their rovers like tiny boats paddle-wheeling over a black sea that had frozen at the height of a titanic storm. One day on this petrified sea, Rover 2 stopped. A red light on the control panel indicated the problem was in the flexible frame between the modules, and in fact, the rear module was tilted to the left, shoving the left side wheels into the sand. Nadia got into a suit and went back to have a look. She took the dust cover off the joint where the frame connected to the module chassis and found that the bolts holding them together were all broken. "This is going to take a while," Nadia said. "You guys might as well have another look around." Soon the suited figures of Phyllis and George emerged, followed by Simon and Anne and Edvard. Phyllis and George took a transponder from Rover 3 and set it out 3 meters to the right of their road. Nadia went to work on the broken frame, handling things as little as possible. It was a cold afternoon, perhaps 70 below, and she could feel the diamond chill right down to the bone. The ends of the bolts wouldn't come out of the side of the module, so she got out a drill and started drilling new holes. She began to hum the Sheik of Araby. Anne and Edvard and Simon were discussing sand. It was so nice, Nadia thought, to see ground that wasn't red. To hear Anne absorbed in her work. To have some work to do herself. They had almost reached the Arctic Circle, and it was LS-84 with the northern summer solstice only 2 weeks away, so the days were getting long. Nadia and George worked through the evening while Phyllis heated supper, and then after the meal, Nadia went back out to finish the job. The sun was red in a brown haze, small and round, even though it was near setting. There wasn't enough atmosphere for oblation to enlarge and flatten it. Nadia finished, put her tools away, and had opened the outer lock door of Rover 1 when Anne's voice spoke in her ear. "Oh, Nadia, are you going in already?" Nadia looked up. Anne was on the ridge of the dune to the west, waving down at her, a black silhouette against a blood-colored sky. "That was the idea," Nadia said. "Come on up here a second. I want you to see this sunset. It's going to be a good one. Come on, it'll only take a minute. You'll be glad you did it. There are clouds to the west." Nadia sighed and closed the outer lock door. The east face of the dune was steep. Nadia carefully stepped in the prints Anne had made in her ascent. The sand there was packed and held firm most of the time. Near the crest it got steeper, and she leaned forward and dug in with her fingers. Then she was clambering onto the broad, rounded crest and could straighten up and have a look around. Only the crests of the tallest dunes were still in sunlight. The world was a black surface, marred by short, scimitar curves of steely gray. Horizon about 5 kilometers off. Anne was crouching, a scoop of sand in her palm. "What's it made of?" Nadia asked. "Dark, solid mineral particles." Nadia snorted. "I could have told you that." "Not before we got here, you couldn't. It might have been fines aggregated with salts, but it's bits of rock instead." "Why so dark?" "Volcanic. On Earth, sand is mostly quartz, you see, because there's a lot of granite there, but Mars doesn't have much granite. These grains are probably volcanic silicates, obsidian, flint, some garnet. Beautiful, isn't it?" She held out a handful of sand for Nadia's inspection. Perfectly serious, of course. Nadia peered through her faceplate at the black grit. "Beautiful," she said. They stood and watched the sun set. Their shadows went right out to the eastern horizon. The sky was a dark red, murky and opaque, only slightly lighter in the west over the sun. The clouds, Anne had mentioned, were bright yellow streaks, very high in the sky. Something in the sand caught at the light, and the dunes were distinctly purplish. The sun was a little gold button, and above it shone 2 evening stars, Venus and the Earth. "They've been getting closer every night lately," Anne said softly. "The conjunction should be really brilliant." The sun touched the horizon, and the dune crests faded to shadow. The little button sun sank under the black line to the west. Now the sky was a maroon dome, the high clouds the pink of moss campion. Stars were popping out everywhere, and the maroon sky shifted to a vivid dark violet, an electric color that was picked up by the dune crests so that it seemed crescents of liquid twilight lay across the black plain. Suddenly Nadia felt a breeze swirl through her nervous system, running up her spine and out into her skin. Her cheeks tingled, and she could feel her spinal cord thrum. Beauty could make you shiver. It was a shock to feel such a physical response to beauty, a thrill like some kind of sex. And this beauty was so strange, so alien. Nadia had never seen it properly before, or never really felt it, she realized that now. She had been enjoying her life as if it were a Siberia made right, so that really she had been living in a huge analogy, understanding everything in terms of her past. But now she stood under a tall, violet sky on the surface of a petrified black ocean, all new, all strange. It was absolutely impossible to compare it to anything she had seen before, and all of a sudden the past sheared away in her head, and she turned in circles like a little girl trying to make herself dizzy without a thought in her head. Weight seeped inward from her skin, and she didn't feel hollow anymore. On the contrary, she felt extremely solid, compact, balanced. A little thinking boulder set spinning like a top.